Chapter 3 The Fourth Wall. I reassemble the violin case on the kitchen table, while Bob moves around upstairs, assembling his go bag and adding an extra supply of necessities. His footsteps are heavy and drag, as if he's drunk. My hands are shaking, and I have to sortie to the bathroom for sticking plasters a couple of times, but I finally succeed in fitting the case back together again. I retrieve the bow and violin, then fetch the cleaning kit. Then I focus on the fingerboard so intently that the sound of the front door closing takes me by surprise. I realize with a start that my husband has left me without saying goodbye. I shut the case and leave it on the kitchen table. To my mild surprise, I feel numb and distant. It feels wrong. I should be angry, bitter and burning, and full of rage and resentment. I ought to be furious with the violin, which is sleeping smug and satiated in its bone-white coffin case, having finally gotten its way. I should be pissed off at Mary for having injected herself back into Bob's life like some kind of vile parasitic worm. At least Ramona has the decency to stay away and lead a life of her own. I should be having a screaming jealousy fit at my husband for fucking that bitch, or worse, for not fucking her, and for being so oblivious to the possibility and to what it might mean to me that he didn't realise offering her crash space in our living room while I was away without telling me might be open to misinterpretation. I should be mourning Angleton, the scary old coffin dodger. I should be having a screaming breakdown fit right now, shouting imprecations at the setting moon and throwing toiletries out of the window. But I'm not. I'm just icily over-controlled, methodically going through the motions. How very grown up of me. Around 6 o'clock, I realise I'm yawning uncontrollably. My emotional state is freewheeling downhill with burned-out brakes. I'll be unable to put up a fight if Lecter tries to romance me in my dreams. Also, my mobile phone is down to about 30% of battery charge, which is bad, if I'm even potentially on call. So I take precautions. I lock and bolt the front door, arm the burglar alarm, check and then power up the protective grids on all the windows, and prepare for a siege. The living room window, it turns out, is both intact and closed. Bob must have seen to it on his way out. Damn him for his consideration. I pick up the violin case and carry it upstairs. We have a big old wardrobe in the bedroom, and there's a lock on its door. I bed Lecter down between Bob's mothballed funeral suit and a random selection of dresses left over from the last decade of wedding invitations. Lock the wardrobe. Carefully draw a basic containment ward around the lock using my conductive sharpie, then take the key downstairs and put it inside the ceramic jar of pre-ground coffee. Bob carefully left an old crowbar under the bed some years ago, just in case. So in event of a real emergency, I can get to the violin without going downstairs. But I'd rather not make it too easy. I'm not a sleepwalker. But there's always a first time. Finally, I use the bathroom, then lock myself in the bedroom, plug in my phone, and set an alarm for noon. And so to bed, perchance to sleep like a log. And by some miracle, Lecter leaves me alone. Unfortunately, I do not get my full lie-in. I vaguely register confused sensations of a furry face pushing against my head. But I grew up in a house with cats, and I can ignore spooky ruthlessly, even in my sleep. But an hour before my alarm call, at about 10 to 11, my ears register the distant ringing of the work telephone in the kitchen. I'm asleep when it rings the first time, but by the second, I am on my feet, and by the third, I walk straight into the closed and locked bedroom door. Swearing ensues. It takes me 11 rings, 6 more than usual, to get to the phone, and I pick it up bleary-eyed and panting. Yes, I gasp, certain that something is wrong. Then I realise what it is. Bob would normally have answered the phone because he sleeps on the side of the bed nearest the door. Ops desk. Is that Agent Candid? 2 calls in 12 hours? Yes, I admit, and authenticate myself. What is it? Sorry to bother you after last night, but we have a... The DO sounds reticent, which is just plain wrong. Peculiar situation emerging. How soon can you get to Trafalgar Square? With your instrument. What for? We want you to busk. Flummoxed is my middle name. You want me to busk why, precisely? In Trafalgar Square. Don't you need a license to... The police will cover for you. It would be best if you dressed casual. A mature student out having fun, something like that. My mouth flaps uselessly as I try to process this vexing, not to say patronising, instruction. I don't know how to explain to the DO that most music students aren't in their early 40s. Maybe I just look young for my age. I sigh. I'll give it a try. What's the plan? There's a developing situation on the fourth plinth, and we need someone to keep an eye on it who isn't going to draw attention and who is equipped to intervene if it escalates. All our reserves are committed after last night, so, I know this sounds bad, but when I say we're scraping the barrel, I mean we're totally overcommitted and running on 120%, and we didn't want to disturb you, but we're entirely out of unobtrusive assets. Suddenly it clicks. You want me because I'm socially invisible. You could put it like that. Personally, I'd rather not, but Colonel Lockhart said you'd understand. He ends on a whimper blue shifting into a whine, and so he should. The landline phone is a 1940s-era Bakelite and steel assembly. If it was made of flimsy modern plastics, my death grip would be crumbling it to splinters at this point. I'll be there in an hour, I snarl, then slam the receiver down so hard that it bounces. The laundry is... regrettably top-heavy with men of a certain age. Institutional culture propagates down the decades, and however much we may want change, change takes time. As it happens, the laundry is a lot better today than it was when I was sucked into the machinery a decade ago. We're part of the civil service, and we're required to follow anti-discrimination law to the letter, and for the most part we do an okay job. But, as with all organisations, shit trickles down from the top. And if the assholes at the top hold antediluvian attitudes formed in previous decades, you're going to have to keep practising your shit-eating grin until they retire. In this particular case, I am forced to admit that Lockhart has a valid point. Women over a certain age become socially invisible. People just ignore us. I'm close enough to the tipping point that if I don't take care of my appearance, I can fall foul of it. It's a very strange experience, being the invisible middle-aged woman. You can walk into a shop or restaurant or a bar, and eyeballs just seem to slide past you as if you aren't there. When you're trying to get served, it's infuriating, sometimes to the point of being humiliating as well, but... in our line of work. Sometimes having a passive cloak of invisibility that doesn't set off every thaum detector within a kilometre comes in handy. Okay, Mo, you can do this. One step at a time. Treat it as an exercise in street theatre. You can do that, can't you? I grumble to myself as I refill the cat's bowl, retrieve my instrument, run a brush through my hair, which is lank from the seaside air and subsequent helicopter ride. Slept insufficiently that it's probably on the edge of becoming a des res for upwardly mobile dormice. And hunt out casual wear I'd ordinarily have relegated to housework only use. I pick out jeans, a chunky cable knit sweater, what used to be a nice flying jacket of Bob's, a comfy but worn pair of DMs, and by way of accessories, a Liberty scarf and a black beret that have both seen better days. Yeah, that's my boho mature student persona, baby. For a moment, I contemplate going hipster instead, but that might stand out. A smear of lipstick, and a battered leather handbag, and I'm ready to serenade the one-legged pigeons of London. I collect my instrument, head for the end of the street, and flag down a cab, trying not to spook at odd-looking low-slung black cars or random passers-by. Taxis are expensive, but I'm going to take a how-soon-can-you-call-by-the-DO as a carte blanche to run up a tab. I need to get to Charing Cross, I tell the driver. She nods, drops the apocryphal fifth wheel that allows the black cab to pivot in place, then floors the accelerator. London traffic is its normal self, which is to say composed entirely of nose-to-tail black cabs, red buses, and confused delivery drivers. Bike couriers weave in and out of the intermittently stationary vehicles without once demonstrating their possession of a survival instinct. I cringe at a couple of near misses and hunker down in the back, wishing the windows were tinted. I feel way too exposed out here. Exposed and trapped simultaneously. A killer on a stolen motorbike could come up behind us while we're stopped at traffic lights and put two bullets in the back of my head and I wouldn't even see them approaching. Try not to think about it. There are commuters on bicycles and numerous tourists pedalling along gamely on bright blue Boris bikes. Maybe I should have rented one instead of paying the cabbie. Tried to blend in with the anonymous hordes. It might even have been faster. She drops me precisely outside the nearest entrance to Charing Cross Tube Station. I thank her and head towards the confused mass of pedestrian crossings on the Strand. It takes me a minute or two to make it to the edge of the square, where I pause beneath the supercilious gaze of the one-eyed admiral, mentally tug my middle-aged invisibility cloak tight around my shoulders, and take stock of my surroundings. In the middle of the square, the fountains fronted by Nelson's Column. At each corner, the four plinths, three of them surmounted by pompous Victorian triumphalist statues. General Sir Henry Havelock, General Sir Charles James Napier, and his knobby knobness King George IV, who was not even remotely as pompous as his statue suggests. Over to the left at the back, there's the infamously empty fourth plinth, subject of the duty officer's scrutiny. And the instant I clap eyes on it, I realise that we have a problem. No, make that a problem. The fourth plinth is one of those British affectations which we love to parade around in public as a sign of our broad-minded tolerance and love of eccentricity. It's actually just another classical stone plinth, originally intended to support an equestrian statue. It's been empty for about 150 years because nobody could agree who to put on it. Then around the turn of the millennium, the Royal Society of Art said, "Oi, can we borrow the spare plinth? It's an art thing." And since then it's been occupied by an ever-changing succession of arts projects. Sometimes a statue, sometimes an abstract sculpture, sometimes a random member of the public reciting poetry or narrating Shakespeare in Semaphore. Today, there appears to be a human pyramid on the plinth. Or maybe it's a rugby scrum, or a public orgy or a sponsored die-in. I'm not sure because I'm at the other side of the square and there are a lot of people between me and the plinth. But in any case, there's what looks like a pile of naked human bodies up there. Here and there, a leg or arm flops limply over the side. I sit on one of the steps and open the violin case. Pigeons rattle and flap their way across the flagstones. I force myself not to let them distract me, even though they remind me too damn much of the seagulls swirling around the oil rig. at the far side of the square. I spot a van with a satellite uplink dish on its roof, and an open door. A journalist with cameraman in tow. They seem to be looking up at the plinth. I lift Lecter and his bow out, latch the case closed, and sling it across my shoulder. Standing, violin in hand, I scan for police. There's always a car or two, or a van drawn up around the edge. Today I spot three vans and four cars, one with the distinctive markings of an armed response vehicle. They're all parked along the west side of the square. A handful of bobbies and stabbies are dispersed among the crowd, which is no thinner or thicker than I'd expect for a weekday in one of the nation's most prominent tourist attractions. No sign of anything particularly unusual, though, except... whoa! I'm so startled by what I see that I speak aloud. Nobody pays me any attention, though, because everybody else who sees it responds the same way. A woman floats into the air in front of the plinth. She's a yummy mummy type, modishly dressed, with a matchingly accessorized baby in a buggy the size of a Range Rover. She's waving her arms and legs like an upside-down beetle clinging onto the pushchair, which is also airborne, for grim death. I can just about hear her desperate screams for help above the traffic noise and the hum of the crowd, as she levitates alongside the 4-meter-tall slab of marble. The pushchair tilts sideways and sheds its load. A rain of baby bottles and nappies splatter to the ground. The woman screams again and loses her grip on the buggy. It drops for a moment, then swoops and kisses the ground in a controlled landing. Its securely strapped in passenger laughs and claps appreciatively. She, however, is not so lucky. Whatever force holds her airborne raises her higher, then slides her over the pile of bodies on the plinth. Then invisible hands start to undress her in mid-air. I look around. Police are dotted around the plinth, but they seem reluctant to approach it. I look closer and see they're putting down cones and unrolling incident tape. Shit. The woman is naked now. Suddenly she stops thrashing as if paralyzed or stunned. Her invisible assailant floats her slowly over the plinth, then lowers her atop the mound of bodies. Oh shit, I hope she's not dead. I stand up and start to walk towards the middle of the square. This isn't a gumshoe job anymore.
Sorry, miss, you can't go there. Turn around and go back. Stop right there.
I stop, because there's not much point trying to walk right through the 2-meter-tall slab of London's finest, who has just stepped in front of me. Looking past his shoulder, I spot another couple of vans pulling up. Cops in riot gear climbing out and forming a line facing outwards around the plinth, like a kettling in reverse. I pull out my warrant card and hold it where he can't ignore it. Take me to your incident controller.
You can't.
He goes cross-eyed as the warrant card grabs his undivided attention and digs in. Footnote, laundry warrant cards have this power. In addition to identifying the holder, they carry a powerful gesh that enables the holder, as long as they're on official business, to convince any other servant of Her Majesty's government that you're a superior. Footnote to the footnote, don't try this on the Prime Minister or the Queen.
You want Detective Chief Inspector Sullivan, boss? She's over there.
He gestures.
Follow me.
A big navy blue mobile command centre is busily shoehorning itself into a parking spot just around the corner in Pall Mall, and my guide leads me straight towards it. I've got my hands full with my instrument right now, which is a problem. I think I need to call in my own mobile support team. We approach the bus, just as a knot of police officers converge on it. A short woman with a no-nonsense attitude is giving the marching orders. I'm about to raise my warrant card when she turns and stares at me. And I recognise her.
Oh, good, says Josephine. Is this your mess?
I don't know, I only just got here. I shrug, bow and fiddle in either hand. I feel calmer now that I've got a professional to work with.
Got a call an hour ago.
When did it kick off?
Wait.
She turns to her posse.
Peeps, this is Dr. O'Brien.
She works with us. Give her what she asks for. Any questions, bring them to me.
Now, get moving.
If I were the praying kind, I'd think my wishes were answered. Joe Sullivan is one of our direct contacts within the Met. She's worked with us on and off for longer than I've been doing field work. In fact, last time I saw her, she was working for our internal affairs people. I suppose it was inevitable she'd rotate back into the regular force, given the number of paranormal events they must be handling these days. Anyway, if I'd been asked to name the cop I wanted to see in charge of this, she'd be at the top of my list. She turns back to me.
78 minutes ago, body number one goes flying up to Situationist Art Show Heaven. Male Australian backpacker mid-20s, best we can tell. Infrared camera on the chopper says they're still warm and breathing, but they're not moving and whatever's doing it likes its bananas peeled.
She glances at her tablet.
We're up to a count of 12 bodies now, but nobody has any idea who or what is responsible. We sent up the bat signal for Officer Friendly, but he's not answering.
Officer Friendly?
She raises an eyebrow. Haven't met him yet. He's one of ours. Nominally, he's with ACPO, but they're stretched too thin. Probably still tangled up in paperwork and witness statements from his last big call-out.
Her frustration is palpable.
I don't want to have to cordon off Trafalgar Square, but if we can't find the perp...
Well, let me put my kit down and I'll see if the office knows anything. We're standing next to a van with open doors. I put Lecter and his beau on the front seat while I pull out my phone and dial.
Duty desk? O'Brien here. Can you put me through to whoever thought it was a good idea to send me over to Trafalgar Square without a plan?
Yes, Dr. O'Brien, transferring you now.
Good morning, Mo.
I recognise Jerry Lockhart's gravelly voice.
What's going on?
I resist the urge to roll my eyes. We have a major incident going on in Trafalgar Square, and you're asking me? Something is stripping tourists naked and building a pile of bodies on the fourth plinth. Paralysing them too. The police have no idea, and they're on the edge of... Sudden shouting distracts me. I hunch my head over to hold my phone against my shoulder and turn to see what's going on.
Oh, fuck, it just escalated. Got to go, I'll call you back.
Another body is floating upwards. He's hanging on to his trademark bicycle by the handlebars, legs pedaling furiously in midair. Portly, his suit rumpled and his mass of unkempt hair flopping across his forehead, he is instantly recognisable as the Mayor of London.
Oh dear fucking Christ on a crutch,
mouths Josephine, her eyes round with horror. I wince and nod in sympathy.
Get him,
she shouts. Cops are already converging on the levitating mayor like a pack of hounds in pursuit of a fox. The unspeakable in full pursuit of the uneatable. He floats above them, calling for help. One of them jumps high enough to grab the rear wheel of the bike, but dangles for barely a second before it slips from the mayor's grip. He lands with a crash, and the mayor floats higher. I ring off, then fumble through the phone's confusing mass of icons until I get into the off-cut suite. Occult sensors and countermeasures. Yes, we do indeed have an app for that. I raise the phone and slowly pan it across the square. The mayor struggles are limbed in green. the contours of the thumb field outlined by the phone's modified camera chip. The bodies atop the plinth also glow. Aha! I tap Josephine's shoulder to get her attention. She whirls. Yes? She demands. Don't be too obvious about it, I say, keeping my voice quiet and conversational. But our merry prankster appears to be human. Which is a huge relief, because human problems, however exotic, usually have human solutions. The alternatives are all much, much worse. He's chilling out on the northeast plinth, between the legs of the horse. His silhouette is lit up like a laser-backlit emerald in my phone's display, but when I try to look at him with my Mark I peepers, they just don't seem to want to see him. It's far too easy to focus on the horse's head or the stone plinth beneath it. He's got some kind of invisibility field, but he's definitely responsible. Shimmering green contrails link his swooping hands to the body of his current victim. Charming, she grins savagely. Let's lift him. No. I slide my phone back into my jacket pocket, then collect Lecter from the van. We have no idea of his full capabilities. So far, he's given us telekinesis, paralysis, and observation avoidance. That's quite a hat trick, isn't it? But we don't know it's all he's capable of. And there are his victims to consider. Her smile vanishes. If we take him down, does the paralysis suddenly wear off? If so, they're lying naked on top of a 4-meter-high platform above flagstones. Someone is going to fall and break something if they start moving. Damn. And there's the motivation issue to consider. Yes. I pause. Do you have any ideas? Above the plinth, the Mayor of London is twirling around his long axis like a plucked chicken on a rotisserie. His coat has taken flight and is flapping around the top of Nelson's column like a demented raven. His shoes pop off like champagne corks as our prankster prepares to debag the old Etonian. Beneath him, that damn TV camera is presumably getting the lead item for tonight's news channels. Public safety comes first. I need to get a couple of squads ready to rush in airbags, Josephine decides. Then someone to disable him. On my word. She takes a deep breath. Then her eyes flicker towards the mayor. I don't want to authorize lethal force, but I may have to if he escalates further. All of that's going to take time, and I'd rather not go there. Can you distract him at least? Or immobilize him? I look around the square. It's actually busier, if anything. Except for the area immediately around the plinth that the police have got cordoned off. I can distract him, and I can probably disable him. Unlike Joe, I don't need to go up a level to authorize force. I answer to my oath, my conscience, and the auditor's. Give me a minute to report in, then I'll go and make a song and dance under his nose. If he gives me grief, I'll take him down. You could help by having some bodies standing by to bag him. Starting in, I check my watch. 5 minutes? You've got 3. If we don't nail him fast, someone's going to get hurt. She heads for the steps of the mobile incident room. I walk across the crowded plaza, gaze downcast to avoid eye contact with the people I'm using for cover. Anything to keep from standing out until I'm in position. The police are clearing the northwest corner of the square by forming a line, elbow to elbow, and expanding it. Josephine's obviously told them to keep it low-key and friendly because there's a marked lack of jostling and riot shields. They are having to work at it, though, because if there is one thing guaranteed to attract the attention of tourists and locals alike, it's the sight of a levitating semi-naked mayor. The square is stippled with the diamante glitter of camera fill-in flashes. I have to shimmy to avoid the elbows and backpacks of oblivious non-natives stopping dead to peer at their tourist guides. My line of sight on George IV is tenuous. And in any case, I can't be too obvious about keeping an eye on him and remain invisible. Rather than heading directly towards the Joker, I stroll in a wide curve around the outside of the square, violin at my shoulder, and bow poised. Finally, I find a reasonable pitch. It's nothing special, just a patch of flagstones beside a low wall that isn't already occupied by a tour group or another musical hopeful. But it's about 50 metres away from Georgie and his unseen passenger. And I've got a sight line on the police around the fourth plinth, and past them, the mobile incident command vehicle. I unsling the empty violin case and lay it open at my feet, just like every other busker. Then, I flex my fingers. Lecter is sleepy and reluctant to rise to full awareness. Good. While he's in this state, he's little more than a regular instrument. I check the pickups and switch off the small preamp built into his lower bout.
What are you doing?
I ignore him and start to tune up. The strings are just about right. The damp sea air didn't have a chance to affect them. Excellent. I check my watch. It's time. I launch into the Ciccone from Bach's Partita in D minor, because I can do it in my sleep while reserving 90% of my attention for keeping track of developments and, more importantly, Lecter is used to me using it as a basic exercise, rather than the prelude to an attack.
What are you doing?
He whines. I let him see the statue through my eyes, complete with a disturbing blind spot between the front legs of the horse.
Ah.
I turn slowly to gaze in the direction of the plinth. The mare twirls slowly, stripped back to a pair of polka-dotted navy boxers. As I watch, they begin to slide south. He grabs them. For a moment he keeps his grip, but then the fabric rips and they fly away. Oh my. I mouth, nearly losing my fingering. The spangle and flicker of camera flashes rises to a manic intensity. I know exactly what's going to be on the front page of all the newspapers tomorrow. Then I turn back towards my target. Lend me your vision, I instruct Lecter as I stare across the bridge of my instrument. My vision greys out for a moment, and then returns. Some colours are emphasised. There's a strange lambency to the air between the horse's hooves, and it slowly resolves into the shape of a seated human figure.
Can I eat him?
No, I convey through the tension of my fingertips. Mine, not yours.
Hungry.
Nevertheless, I tighten my grip and draw on the violin's power. Bach, I decide, is inappropriate. This calls for something more contemporary. I segue into a different form, a more rhythmic, sinister melody wrapped around an implicit beat. Bela Lugosi's Dead, for solo improv violin values of mortality. Now, I relax my grip on Lecter's appetite, and he strains forward eagerly, sucking on the energy source in front of him. The blind spot twists and twitches slightly, then begins to shrink. Arms and legs slide into view. Hands move agitated. Laughing Boy has finally begun to realize that something is wrong. Out of the corner of my eye, I spot the mayor standing on top of the pile of naked bodies on the other plinth. He's waving and gesticulating in my direction. Is he a sensitive? Shit. There's nothing to be done about it if he is. I press on, raising the bow for a second. I flip the switch on my violin's preamp. It's not an audio amplifier, and those aren't electronic pickups. I started subtle, but now it's time to party. The bats have left the belfry. And I'm almost airborne. Whoops. My ward buzzes angrily, and I hastily squirt juice into it. Juice sucked from the joker on the plinth, who has taken aim at me. I land with a painful jolt, but manage to absorb the drop with my knees. I'll feel them tomorrow, but I'm rooted to the ground for now. I increase both volume and tempo, whirling into a screaming blur as the song rises. The strings begin to glow, and now I reach out with Lecter's power and wrap my will around my target. The victims have been bled. Gotcha. He struggles as I lift him into the air, stabbing at me with pulses of near-solid air that would rupture eardrums and break bones if I didn't have a ward in place, drawing on the near-infinite depths of the violin's power. I stare at him as he screams obscenities and lashes out at me. For a moment, I wonder if I've caught a giant frog. Then I realise he's just a little overweight. Beer guts and lycra body stockings really don't play well together.
Put me down, you motherfucking hippie bitch! Put me down or I will rape you so hard you'll walk bow-legged for a month!
I tighten my grip on him, and he shuts up, unable to draw breath. I see red. Heart pounding, and head throbbing in time to the beat I'm imagining. Laughing Boy likes to strip the clothes off young women in public as he adds them to the pornographic sculpture he's building on the empty plinth. Laughing Boy thinks rape jokes are funny? Laughing Boy thinks it's all fun and games until a motherfucking hippie bitch turns his own mojo back on him, does he? I'll show him. I'll squeeze him until his guts explode. Stop that, I tell Lecter. Laughing Boy is turning blue in the face, eyes bulging as I dangle him above the heads of the crowd. Almost like the bodies on the giant gallows in Vakilabad. I let him down gently, in the middle of a knot of riot police, then stop the music dead and lower my instrument. Oh God, oh God, oh God, I mumble. The residual power surge warms the protective ward at the base of my throat. I feel sick. I nearly hanged a man with a noose of ear. But he threatened to. That's disproportionate. Rape you? He's just a sad middle-aged man with no life who has suddenly acquired superpowers and then decided to have some fun and sexually abuse random passers-by in public. And I believe we should have a little word with Joe Sullivan and stop arguing with yourself, yes? I put my instrument away, pick up the case, and begin to walk towards the mobile incident command vehicle. And that's when I see the other TV uplink van that was parked behind me, and the BBC news crew with the camera tracking me for my reaction shot, when I realise they broadcast the entire magical duel live on News 24. Now, it is a fact universally acknowledged by the modern intelligence agent that whoever said lies could travel halfway around the world while the truth was still getting its running shoes on clearly lived in a YouTube-free bubble. I am a professional. I do not blog. I do not leak. I am discreet. I do not tweet. I do have a Facebook page, because not having one would mark me out as a freak of nature in this disclosure-obsessed age, but it's monitored by human resources, and I don't talk about work or politics, and I don't friend my colleagues. When a BBC camera crew shoves a microphone under my nose, and a vaguely familiar face with an expensive hairdo and a fashionable suit starts asking me pointed questions, I politely redirect their inquiries towards the nearest uniformed police superintendent, then walk away, mouthing "get me out of here" in Joe Sullivan's direction. Which is how I get my second ride home in a jam sandwich with flashing blues and twos in just under 12 hours. Cringing in the back seat every time I notice a random bystander who looks like a journalist or a van that resembles the TV news crew's uplink vehicle. The neighbours are going to think I'm some kind of criminal mastermind at this rate, aren't they? I'm in the kitchen, brewing up a cafetiere of Kenyan on autopilot, as Spooky rubs against my ankles in hope of attention, when the landline from HQ rings. It's Vikram.
You made quite a splash.
His tone is surprisingly mild. I didn't mean to. The second camera crew arrived while I was already engaged. I shudder convulsively and bite down on my instinctive urge to start apologising. It's undignified for one thing, and for another, if I start, I don't know if I'll be able to stop. What happens next?
We're meeting at 3 to discuss damage control policy. The auditors are calling the shots on this one, I'm afraid. We're using room 4102 in Admiralty House just off the Spring Gardens entrance. The new annex is inaccessible today.
The new annex is what?
Last night's code red left quite a mess.
Vic isn't normally quite this taciturn. He must be badly rattled.
We're activating the emergency migration plan while the cleanup proceeds.
I see. Stiff upper lips appear to be the order of the day. Well, my workplace calendar is clear. I was supposed to be stuck in the middle of the North Sea for the rest of the week, so it's not as if I'm expected in the office, apart from this new meeting. But the sense of hollow dread and loss gnawing at my guts won't go away. How bad is the public exposure?
Bad. He pauses. Chin up, and see you in a few hours.
Whoops.
I set the timer on my phone to give me a countdown alarm, sit down at the kitchen table, and allow the tears to flow. It's not hard, and the therapeutic effect of a good cry shouldn't be underestimated. You secrete endorphins in your tears, and there's a good chunk of research showing that it really does relieve stress. Trial and error experimentation has taught me that an 8-minute session, followed by 7 minutes of deep breathing and meditation, is the minimum I can get away with to rebalance myself when I'm in danger of losing my shit completely. It used to be 4 minutes back when I started practicing it a couple of years ago. It's been creeping up on me for some time now. If I follow it with a brief session of calming meditation, it sets me right as rain. For a while. 15-minute interval over, and feeling a lot better for it. I haul my suitcase upstairs and shower, then wash and blow-dry my hair. Opening the bag, I haul out the black trouser suit I bought for the deep-sea negotiations. Add a cream blouse, heels, and just enough makeup and earrings to soften the look slightly. And it'll be just about right for what's coming up this afternoon, which is inevitably going to be suspension, followed by a formal inquiry with the authority to recommend disciplinary sanctions. I hadn't thought things could get any worse after Bob left, but this is ridiculous. Nope, wrong word. Try disastrous on for size instead. I do not overshare on Facebook. Unfortunately, I have an idiot sister who thinks Facebook is the internet and that the internet is the right way to keep in touch with her friends. 12% of all the photographs ever taken in human history have been taken in the last 12 months, and 40% of them are on Facebook. Many of these photographs are taken at family social gatherings, and the people who upload them tag them with the names of their relatives and friends. Which means that unless you are a paranoid recluse who has been hiding in a cave since the early 1980s, there is almost certainly a photograph of your face tagged with your name and public profile in Facebook's database. An hour ago, I took down an angry white guy with occult powers in the middle of Trafalgar Square. I don't think I had any alternative. He was holding the Mayor of London hostage, the man most likely to be our next Prime Minister, not to mention a dozen innocent bystanders. Unfortunately, I did so right in front of a TV news crew and about 1,000 tourists armed with DSLRs and SD cards that automatically upload everything they see to the internet via wireless. Back in the prehistoric era of the 1980s, we could stop this shit dead in its tracks. The TV and newspaper crews could be silenced by means of a quaint instrument called a D-notice, a formal warning that publication would put them in breach of the Official Secrets Act and result in prosecution. The ordinary witnesses carried cameras full of film that could be confiscated, and which in any case couldn't be tagged and matched and searched on the internet. But today, Let's just say Sis is in for a real surprise the next time she checks in on Facebook. I get dressed, put my hair up, apply foundation, eyeliner and lipstick, then go downstairs. With a growing sense of dread, I fire up the laptop and start poking at dusty news sites. I've got about half an hour before it'll be time to set off. Time to see if I need to keep my head down. It's not looking good. I am squarely in the frame of the photograph that accompanies the lead news item on the BBC News website. Recognisably me, even in casual mufti with a rat's nest under my beret. The same video clip is on YouTube. It has been viewed 223,195 times already. Make that 223,196. There are links to 6 more videos of the incident, from different angles. One of them was taken by a Korean tourist whose funky high-def camera had some sort of bizarre polarising filter that is sensitive to thaw fields, bolts of psychedelic lightning zig and zag across the concourse, roughly connecting Lecter to Laughing Boy, who shows up in luminous green. There's an interview with the mayor from his hospital bed, breathlessly expressing his gratitude and admiration to the redhead with the violin, who took down Stripjack's brat, as the supervillain Monkey apparently calls himself. Alias? Dougal Slaithwaite, age 52, unemployed, of no fixed abode, now facing charges of kidnapping, indecent assault, and threatening behaviour. There are linked news items, human interest colour I gather, about other superhero outbreaks. Who ordered that? Apparently my media habit is sufficiently out of the mainstream that I've been missing out on the summer's big story. There are more than 70 messages waiting for me in my Facebook inbox. I delete them all. Another one appears almost immediately. I log out. I don't bother checking the newspapers. Instead, I repack my suitcase, adding my second best suit in place of the one I'm wearing. It may be some time before I can come home without running a gauntlet of journalists. The first of them may already be on their way depending on how good they are at image manipulation and social engineering. As I said, Sis is in for a real surprise next time she checks in. But for me, it's time to face the music. I phone for a cab, and they pick me up at my front door. My skin's crawling as I do the perp walk out to the curb, but there are no tabloid reporters or paparazzi waiting in the bushes yet. It's a lucky escape that I can't count on repeating. I feel nauseous as I contemplate what's coming up next. An auto da fe, if I'm lucky. Utter shame otherwise. Of course the cabbie turns out to be the talkative kind. "Did you hear about the mess in Trafalgar Square?" he asks. "I'm going to have to loop around to drop you on Pall Mall. That end's all blocked off. One of those supervillains went off his trolley and kidnapped the mayor. Then some girl with a magic guitar took him down right in front of Nelson's Column. The news is saying she works for a secret government agency," he confides with a knowing look. "I'm sure she does." I cross my arms and peer out of the window, feigning boredom. I'm certain he can hear my pulse pounding over the noise of the lorry we're nose to tail with. "Stands to reason. The government must have some kind of plan for dealing with him, right?" He sounds worried. "Them? Yeah. The crazies with superpowers. Crazies with..." I catch his eye in the mirror, looking at me as if he's wondering what planet I'm from. "Yeah, crazies. Like the bloke what tore up that community centre in Tooting last week, with his bare hands. It's anarchy, that's what it is, even with all these crime fighters and pervert suits coming out the woodwork." "Pervert suits?" I ask, caught by his phrasing. "Yeah, it's like there's some kind of law or something. Ordinary bloke acquires a power to turn his head into a teapot. He has to start poncing around in lycra and fishnets. Like something from the Rocky Horror, innit? You know what? That sort of thing turns my stomach. There ought to be a law against it."
What, turning your head into a teapot?
No, the pervy suits. I mean, no offence, if a fit bird with superpowers wants to wear a skimpy dress and thigh-high boots, I've got no problem, know what I mean? But some of these blokes, they're a bit past their sell-by. There ought to be a law about it, right? They should make all the fat supervillains wear burkas. But they ain't doing anything about any of it right now, looks like. It's a crime. The police should do something.
And so on, and on, and on. For approximately 25 minutes. By the time we arrive at the Admiralty, my cheek is twitching, and if I had my choice of superpowers, I would cheerfully sell my soul for the ability to turn my driver's head into a cafetiere. I'm so tense by the time we arrive that I forget to ask for a receipt when I pay. But swearing won't help, and I don't feel like running after the taxi, so I make my way stiffly to the front desk, where a splendidly uniformed doorman waits behind a desk carved from the timbers of an 18th century man-o-war. I present my warrant card. Dr. O'Brien, I'm here for a meeting in room 4102. It sounds so much better than disciplinary hearing. If you'd care to sign here, ma'am. Now stare into the camera just for a second. It's one of the ubiquitous eyeball on a stock webcams, disquietingly like something I once met in a hotel hallway in Amsterdam. I try to will the lens to crack, but I'm not quite ugly enough.
Jolly good. Now I'm just going to print you out a badge. Remember to wear it at all times and return it when you leave. I'm afraid you'll have to leave those bags here. You can check them into the cloakroom, but I'm afraid we'll have to scan them.
You can take the suitcase, but the violin has to stay with me. I put it on the desk. You're welcome to inspect it right here, but I can't let it out of my possession. It's rather valuable. I tense up, anticipating a fight.
Really?
He smiles over gilt-framed half-moon glasses.
Well, if you insist, I can hand-search it.
Bless the Corps of Commissioners. They're ex-military enough to know when to bend the rules. We deposit my suitcase. I show him Lecter, and let him hand-check the sides and back of the case. Then I take my badge, and go in search of the borrowed conference room. It's funny how the mere anticipation of a verbal confrontation can be worse than life-and-death combat. My stomach is hollow, and chest a little fluttery. The floors in this building are paved in Italian marble, uncarpeted, utterly lethal if you slip, and liable to cause permanent hearing damage if you walk on them for too long in heels. It's enough to make me long for the beige institutional carpet of the new annex. And then I'm standing in front of a pair of imposing black double doors, framed by Corinthian columns, surmounted by an arch with painted putti, blowing on the sails of ships of the line. I take a deep breath and knock. Twice. Vikram opens the door. He looks nearly as nervous as I feel.
Oh, good. We were getting worried,
he says.
Worried?
Is there a problem? I ask cautiously.
Yes. We've been running interference from upstairs, but...
He steps backwards.
Come on in. We have coffee and refreshments.
I follow him into the room. It's about the size of an aircraft carrier's hangar deck, with baroque gilt-encrusted benches and side tables drawn up against wood-panelled walls that have fossilised under the weight of their decorative plasterwork. The floor-to-ceiling windows admit a waterfall of golden afternoon light that floods the room and washes across a hand-woven Persian carpet that must have cost a prince's ransom.
Ah! Dr. O'Brien.
I nearly jump out of my skin. It's Dr. Michael, never a Mike, Armstrong, the senior auditor. He smiles like a tired crocodile.
What a relief. Are you well?
I manage not to stagger under the weight of his regard. He actually looks concerned.
Have you spoken to Bob this morning?
I ask.
Yes, wait.
Not since the early hours.
His left eyebrow wrinkles.
Is something the matter?
I glance round. He's brought a couple of admin bodies I don't know, but some faces I expected to see are absent. Yes, but I'm not sure it's relevant to the matter in hand.
Where's Judith?
Dead.
What?
Armstrong clasps his hands behind his back, as sober as a funeral director.
Last night, during the Code Red, we were attacked at the new annex.
I knew that, but... Judith? Dr. Carroll was the second-ranking auditor who dealt with our department. I was expecting her to chair this session. She wasn't exactly a friend, but I was certain I'd get a fair hearing from her. And to learn that she's dead so recently comes like a punch in the guts. He looks at me, his expression deceptively mild. We lost others. Oh my God.
Andrew Newstrom, Doris Goodman, James Angleton.
Oh my. My knees nearly give way. Everything's a blur. The next thing I know, the senior auditor has my arm. He's almost holding me up and is leading me towards a chair.
God.
It's not that it's entirely news to me. I knew we'd lost Angleton. But the scale of it hits me hard. And Andy was a friend, not a close one, but a friend nonetheless.
God won't help you, I'm afraid.
The SE murmurs sympathetically. More loudly.
I'm sorry, you should have been kept informed.
But Andy?
Yes.
I feel the hard edge of a chair butt up against my legs. I allow myself to collapse onto it.
Your husband is picking up the pieces.
But he's...
My lips don't seem to want to work properly.
I take a few seconds to get them back under control.
This is a catastrophe.
Yes, he agrees. It puts everything that's happened to me in the past 24 hours in a new perspective. Tilt shift mode, on a shiny new digital camera. All of a sudden, your larger than life problems look like a miniature diorama. Oh God. Bob and I had a huge row if I'd known.
Not to worry,
Dr. Armstrong murmurs gently. He sits down beside me.
I'm sure allowances will be made. Accommodations can be reached, but that's not what we're here for, is it?
Oh, that. No, I agree.
You know what's coming next.
It's a statement, not a question. Give me a couple of seconds, please. This is all a bit of a shock. I reach for the empty chair on my other side and lay Lecter's case there. I try to relax, even though every instinct tells me to tense up. What's coming next is one of the scariest non-violent experiences you can undergo, and if you work for the laundry, you will undergo it, sooner or later. I'm ready now. I turn my head and stare into his eyes, which are deep and brown, and have unusually long lashes.
All right. Sabbath, Claymore, Diamond, Rocket. Execute Sit Rep 1.
My tongue feels like a lump of wood. My eyes do not belong to me. Something inside my head uses my larynx to make its report. Subjective integrity is maintained. Subjective continuity of experience is maintained. Subject observes no tampering.
Good.
The senior auditor smiles warmly.
Execute Sit Rep 2.
Subjective operational readiness state, green. Subjective background state, amber. Trending to red.
Hmm.
His smile slips.
Exit supervision.
A brief pause.
Mo, before we get to the main business of this meeting, in your own words, how was your trip going? Before you were recalled, was there a message for us?
The unseen narrator using my vocal cords goes back to sleep. I clear my throat
as I regain control of my own mind. Ramona invited me to come visit sometime. We had a lengthy gossip sesh. But that's all. Nothing substantial.
Nice to know the neighbours are steady.
The set of his shoulders relaxes slightly. So, tell me what happened in Trafalgar Square. My shoulders tense.
Total screw-up, I'm afraid. I went in under-informed and under-equipped, and didn't even notice the news crew until it was way too late. Also, I'd like to report that I had some self-control issues. Nearly took out my personal frustration on the idiot who caused the scene. Utterly unconscionable. And I was able to stop myself, but...
You need to know.
He raises a hand, and I manage to stop myself before I begin to babble. Then he speaks, his voice low and soothing.
You dealt with a crisis while sleep-deprived, and in the wake of a major domestic argument. And you dealt with it effectively. Did you rough him up? If not, I see no problem here except that perhaps the DO should have looked a little further before assigning assets to deal with what appeared, at first, to be a trivial distraction. That you feel the need to confess that you attempted is creditable. But, under the circumstances, unnecessary. We do not punish people for thought crime, Dr. O'Brien.
He pauses.
And in any event, we would have encountered this particular crisis sooner or later, regardless of who had to deal with the feckless Mr. Spratt. It was just bad luck that it happened to you, rather than to someone else.
What crisis?
I pause long enough to lick my lips.
The Code Red?
Dealt with,
he says, with a dismissive wave of the hand.
The fangs are locked down tight. The external and internal threats have been neutralized.
For a moment, there's a flicker of fire in his eyes.
And damage control is in hand. No, this isn't the disciplinary hearing you were expecting. We have another crisis to deal with.
He gestures at the boardroom table at the far end of the room.
So, whenever you're ready...